Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, no matter how much you push the envelope, can you complete the sentence?
No. No, I'm like trying to like come up with like postage puns or stamps, but no, tell me.
No matter how much you push the envelope, it'll be stationary.
That's not bad.
Vaguely related to the topic.
It's a thinker.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank-Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is a long overdue follow-up episode to our first fantastic dizziness episode with Dr. Newman Toker. Tonight, we are featuring a wonderful guest, Dr. David Hale, who is going to teach us all about dizziness. And that's a topic, Paul, that just strikes a little fear in my heart when I see it on my, you know, chief complaints for the day when I'm looking at a list of patients. But before we talk more about our guest and introduce our co-host, what is it that we do on the Curbsiders, Paul? We've done over 500 episodes. Why are we still here?
It's because we still have so much more to learn, Matt. And as a reminder, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you alluded to, we are joined by co-host and producer for this episode, Edison Eddie Jang. I should say Dr. Jang. Eddie, how are you doing?
I'm great.
You sure are. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who we talked to tonight?
So we have Dr. David Hale. He earned his medical degree at Penn State University and completed a neurology residency at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, remained at Johns Hopkins for fellowship training in vestibular and ocular motor otoneurology. He's interested in resident and fellow medical education, specifically the development of ways to make knowledge of subspecialist neurologists more accessible to those in training. He serves as the co-director of the vestibular and ocular motor otoneurology clinical fellowship at Johns Hopkins. And I liked how he taught us kind of very methodical ways to break down the dizziness. So kind of the main things were kind of acute, chronic, or episodic, and then kind of going forward from there. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. David, we've been talking for a while, and we're thrilled to have you on the show. The audience is dying to hear about a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here. I'm a pretty crafty person, so I really love anything that's hands-on. And most recently, we bought an embroidery machine. So I've been doing some single needle embroidery, making gifts for friends and family, completely something outside of medicine. It doesn't really have a lot of screen time is right up my alley.
I don't know what an embroidery machine looks like. Isn't that, don't they have just that little wooden circle and you put the thing on it and then you just use the needle? Is that?
Yeah, it looks like a sewing machine. So it's like automated or robotic and you can design it and then send a design to the machine and it stitches into the material of your choice.
Okay. All right, I'm going to have to look this up to visualize it. That sounds pretty cool. That sounds like a very like mindful, just like very chill hobby. I'm all for that these days because I feel like I'm just like a ball of stress all the time unless I'm really like mindful about it. So I've been really working on that kind of thing.
I think it's good for you to have something new to obsess over, Matt. So I think that sounds perfect for you. I'm sure you wouldn't be weirdly perfectionist about it. Let's go to, we were talking about sort of mentorship actually before we started recording. So actually, David, let me ask you about advice or feedback that you've either received or that you like to give just to anyone who's in the medical field and does not necessarily have to be medically related.
Yeah, I think some really great advice that I received at the beginning of my career was that I should be as available as possible for my colleagues and for the learners around me. So if someone asks me to see a patient, I say yes. I am always available to help answer a question and share, you know, the knowledge that I'm lucky enough to have to help answer somebody else's question, or when a patient's stuck in a little bit of a predicament, it's good to be able to just step in and be available and
help. I love that so much. This, I think I mentioned this on the show 37 times just because we've been doing this 10 years now, but there was an attending Matt and I used to work with in the CICU who anytime there was a call about a transfer, he would just say, all right, thank you so very much. We're happy to see them. And like, that was the extent of the conversation. There was never any pushback. There was never, like, he was just, we were an open door because he was just happy to take care of patients and they were the best ones suited for it. It was just, that really meant a lot to me, and it still does. I try to practice that same way.
Yeah, it's hard to do when you get really busy and you're, you know, stressed out when people are asking you for your attention. You feel like you have your attention has to go 10 other places. So that's another great thing to practice. Well, we need to, speaking of things I need practice on, vertigo, dizziness, working this up. We did an episode long time ago on this, and we definitely need to refresh our knowledge here. So, Eddie, would you take us into our first case from Cashlack?
So we have Kathy, who is a 65-year-old female with a past medical history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, migraines, and osteoporosis, who is coming to your primary care clinic for dizziness. She states that she has had episodes of dizziness for the past week, which has made it difficult for her to work at the local grocery store. So dizziness is always a vague term. What is your general approach when a patient comes with a primary complaint of dizziness?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's important to remember that we as physicians and healthcare professionals have very precise language when it comes to words like dizziness and vertigo. Dizziness being a sensation of impaired spatial awareness with no false motion, and vertigo being a sensation of false motion when no motion is occurring. But as always in many fields, patients have not read those same textbooks. So they're going to use the words like dizziness, vertigo, imbalance interchangeably. And because of that, you can't really hang your hat on the description of the patient's symptoms, but instead you need to think a little bit more algorithmically. And the way that we do that in our clinic and when I'm teaching about dizziness is by really focusing on the timing of the patient's symptoms and what triggers those symptoms, if there is a trigger, along with the symptoms that are associated with it. So to me, I'm listening to break patient symptoms down into acute vertigo, or acute vestibular syndrome, the episodic vestibular syndrome, whether it's provoked or unprovoked episodic vestibular symptoms, or lastly, fitting them into a bucket of chronic dizziness or chronic vertigo. If something is episodic, I really am honing in on, did this happen spontaneously, or was there a trigger that preceded the patient's symptoms? And of course, I'm always really relying heavily on my associated symptoms, which is in essence your review of systems, to rule out dangerous neurologic causes. You might hear that as the dangerous D's of diplopia, dysarthria, dysphagia, to understand if there's something else neurologic happening. But I'm also doing a good migraine review system so that I don't miss things like headaches, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, and my ear review of systems, so I don't overlook the ENT problem. And even though I'm a neurologist, I still have to ask about the heart and ask about palpitations and, you know, if the patient feels like a, you know, arrhythmia type of symptoms that could be occurring at the same time of their dizziness.
Okay, so that's a lot there. So the three main buckets are, there's acute episode of vertigo or acute vestibular syndrome, we've called it. It can be episodic or it can be chronic vertigo. And if it's episodic, we have to get, is it like triggered or provoked? You know, that's one of the types. Or is it unprovoked? It just kind of came on and we don't know why. And then you said the review of systems, you're asking like diplopia, dysarthria. So, and then you said you ask about headache type symptoms in case of vestibular migraine, and then ear symptoms and heart symptoms, palpitations. So those are, and timing and triggers are, you know, that was where you started that whole thing, asking about timing and triggers. And then we have our buckets, we have our associated symptoms. So I think that's all pretty intuitive. Paul, am I missing anything there in the recap?
No, that's great. It sounds like we're coming up with defined illness scripts and going through semantic modifiers. So fantastic stuff for our medical educators out there.
Okay. Paul, you want to do the next part of the case and we'll keep going?
Sure. So our patient, Kathy, we get an excellent history, and she tells us that she feels more like her environment is spinning, more like the room is spinning, and that it seems to be triggered by turning her head is very short-lived. So this lasts for maybe about a minute before it goes away. She does have nausea during the episodes, but has not noticed any hearing loss. So now we are, so for you, in terms of how you're thinking about this thing, we have something that is now acute. It seems to be provoked, triggered by movements rather than spontaneously. So with those two modifiers in place, what does your differential look like, and where can we go from here to kind of hone things down?
Yeah, so the fact that this is happening multiple times puts her into this episodic bucket. And she has a clear trigger that occurs when she is turning her head. So, you know, the differential for the episodic provoked vestibular syndrome is actually pretty narrow. And the number one cause is BPPV, or benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. But the other, you know, major cause of episodic and positionally induced changes in symptoms is orthostatic hypotension, are the two big things that come to my mind or that I'd be evaluating for in this patient.
I think we know how to look for orthostatic hypotension. The BPPV one, that requires some maneuvers, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Sometimes I find that the person the history is a little squirrely, and it's not so clear that it's triggered. How do you handle that, or how do you try to tease that out? Like if it is episodic, you know, how do you try to figure out if it's something you need to be more worried about or less worried about? Any other things you're asking?
Yeah, of course. So you're exactly right that patients sometimes have absolutely, you know, no idea if there is a trigger related to their symptoms. They just know that they're feeling some sort of dizziness and they don't feel well right now. So whenever someone is in that episodic bucket, the other categories of disease that you don't want to overlook, especially, is a transient ischemic attack, a TIA. That's going to be something that is spontaneous and episodic without a warning sign often. And then more common spontaneous causes of dizziness, though would expect it to be slightly longer, would be things like vestibular migraine or Meniere's disease. When you're thinking about something like TIA, vestibular migraine, or Meniere's disease, a lot of the times you have to really ask the patient what the associated symptoms are. And that's how you're going to help differentiate. You know, for the TIA, you're asking about any other neurologic symptoms that happened at the same time of the event, though isolated dizziness is a possibility to present as a TIA. And for your patients with vestibular migraine, it's the same types of questions you'd be asking in your headaches review of systems, like light or sound sensitivity and a description of that patient's headache, visual aura. And then for our patients with Meniere's, that's when I'm honing in on, you know, did you have hearing loss associated with that episode, that especially that's been fluctuating? I think it's really important to note that TIA is something that is often very brief and doesn't happen repetitively. So while it is something that we all do not want to miss, of course, I don't expect a TIA to happen again, again, and again. And that actually is a little bit reassuring. If somebody's had these events before or have been having them multiple times in the days preceding to my clinic, or even weeks or months before seeing us.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you would key into like on their vascular risk factors to before you would be, you know, like a 20-year-old comes into you with symptoms, you're probably going to be less concerned for a TIA in that case. So let's talk about the diagnosis here. So if she's in, let's say we have Kathy in your office, Can you describe like what you're going to do to try to figure this out? And, you know, one thing we've talked about Dix Hall Pike in the past, and I know there's like, depending on which canal is involved, you might do different maneuvers. And that's something, I guess, maybe since this is like our 2.0 episode for this one, maybe that's something that we can talk a little bit about since we've talked about Dix Hall Pike before.
Yeah, exactly. So in my clinic, and I know like we talk about timing triggers and sorting people correctly, no matter what the patient says to me, when they have dizziness, I always check a Dix Hall Pike, which tests the posterior canals, and I always check a supine roll test, which tests the horizontal canals. Even if I don't think the person has BPPV, I still check because it would be really silly for me to miss or overlook something that we could treat right then and there in clinic. And we do know that while our patients are really great historians, sometimes there's just so much going on that they may not give you the detail that makes you like feel really confident that this is BPPV. So I say it's better safe to just look for BPPV because it's something that you can treat, which is really rewarding for both you and the patient in the office.
And just to caveat, you're saying if they're not having an acute vestibular syndrome, right? If you're working up episodic vertigo.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Good. For the audience, we talked about this on our previous episode with dizziness and vertigo, but if someone has an acute vestibular syndrome, which we will talk about, they're going to be dizzy no matter how you move them. And so it's not the right exam to do. This episode is brought to you by DocsGPT by Doximity. It's Doximity's new HIPAA-compliant AI tool that helps you get quick, evidence-based answers right when you need them. And if you already trust Doximity for Dialer, you know they build tools that actually make your day easier. Listen, I love this kind of AI tool. I've been using DocsGPT regularly as part of my workflow when I have to look things up. Maybe it's a clinical question, maybe it's a drug reference, maybe I just need to write a letter for an insurance company to justify why I need something, and DocsGPT can do all of that. Think of DocsGPT as a ChatGPT for medicine built specifically for clinicians. It gives you concise, reference-backed answers to clinical questions, drug lookups, and the drug info isn't AI-made. It's pulled directly from peer-reviewed literature and FDA data. DocsGPT is private by default, fully HIPAA-compliant, and secure, so you can use it confidently in your clinical workflow. Every U.S. clinician gets 100% free access to DocsGPT, and through Doximity, you also get complimentary access to virtually every medical journal, so you can go from question to citation to source seamlessly and all in one place. It's fast, intuitive, and built right into the Doximity platform. If you haven't tried it yet, check out DocsGPT by Doximity and see how it can simplify your clinical workflow. From patient care to paperwork, visit docsgpt.com or use the link in the show notes to start using it today. That's docsgpt.com. This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Well, imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Listen, I've been using Freed for over 2 years. I can say it works. It is a high quality product and it could potentially change your life and could change your workflow for the better and free you up so that you can spend time at home with your family or doing things you like instead of just charting all the time. Imagine that great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Visit getfreed.ai and use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's getfreed.ai and use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month. Okay, so maybe just briefly talk through the Dix Hall pipe. How does it differ from the supine roll?
Yeah, so I'm going to give like a verbal description of this, but the most important thing is that you try and practice the Dix Hall pipe on a friend or a family member so you can get a feel for it. And I always say just have a bookmarked favorited video of a reliable source so you can refresh and remind yourself what to do. But for the Dix Hall pike or the supine roll, your goal is to align that canal with the plane of the earth or to make that canal parallel to the ground. So that's what these maneuvers are actually doing. So the posterior canal is kind of oriented like your earlobe or like a big pair of elephant ears sticking out of your head. So if I'm testing the right side, I'm going to turn my head about 45 degrees to the right. I'm going to lay the patient down flat and tilt their head back by about 20 to 30 degrees so that the posterior canal is in line with the ground. What you're going to do once you're in that position is you're going to ask the patient to just keep their eyes open, and you're going to observe for the characteristic nystagmus that you would expect when that canal is stimulated. And each of these canals has very specific patterns of nystagmus that you can, you know, look at all the pathways and try and make sense of it all. Or you could just remember that the posterior canal is an upbeat torsional nystagmus. So it's a mixed nystagmus. And the torsion is always named based on the direction that it's turning. So we say with torsion toward the patient's right ear or with torsion towards the patient's right shoulder. We try to avoid words like clockwise or counterclockwise. And of course, you can do that same thing on the patient's left. The supine roll test for the horizontal canal is thankfully a little bit easier. You just have the patient lay down flat on their back and tuck their chin in 20 degrees, and then turn their head all the way to the right to test the right horizontal canal, and then turn the patient's head all the way to the left to test the left horizontal canal. And in horizontal canal BPPV, you're looking for a horizontal nystagmus. So it's either going to be beating to the right when they turn their head to the right and to the left when they turn their head to the left, or which is called geotropic, or beating toward the earth, or it's going to be the opposite pattern of that, which they call apogeotropic. It starts to get a little complicated with the horizontal canal because the crystals can be stuck on different sides of the canal, which is the canal side or the cupula side. So BPPV at its surface seems really simple, but there are just so many variants and so many different maneuvers. I think if you can learn the posterior canal and feel confident with that, you'll be able to diagnose and treat a majority of the cases.
And just to confirm, David, that it's the presence of nystagmus that is consistent, not reproduction of symptoms necessarily?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. So in order to diagnose BPPV, you should see the characteristic nystagmus, and at the same time, the patient should have a reproduction of their symptoms or feel some sort of dizziness or vertigo. If the patient only has subjective symptoms and you don't see the nystagmus, or when somebody is telling me about a case that they saw, the first question I always ask is, well, maybe did you miss the nystagmus when it was there? Because sometimes it can be really brief and for just a few seconds. So it's hard to say, like, well, I didn't see the nystagmus. They don't have BPPV. It's the caveat is, well, did you see the nystagmus? Something we have the availability of in our clinic is a pair of Frenzel goggles, which are a pair of goggles that we put on the patient's eyes, and it removes their visual fixation. Because patients can suppress nystagmus, especially vertical or horizontal nystagmus, with their vision. And if they don't have visual fixation removed when they're in that Dix Hall pike position, you may not see the nystagmus, or you only can see the mild torsional part. So it can get a little bit tricky. But the answer textbook-wise is yes, you have to see both. But my caveat is, you know, make sure you set yourself up for success to be able to see it.
And last 101 question, sorry, Wado, but every place I've ever worked, the exam table, A, is 3,000 pounds, and B, pushed up against the exam room wall.
Yes.
So like you're always, like trying not to bounce the patient's head off the wall while doing, I guess, like how critical is it to actually have the patient's head sort of below the plane of the exam table? Like, I have to assume that's very important.
So in an ideal scenario, that would be the easiest. But what I often do is I stack pillows under the patient's shoulder blades so that, you know, they're going to hit a pillow and then their head is going to be on the edge of the pillow hanging off. Does that make sense?
It does. That feels like the exact pro tip that we're looking for with these. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, let's say you're in a room that for some reason doesn't have a table. You can technically have the patient scoot forward in their chair and lean back off the edge of a chair with their head backward and tilted off if they're flexible or mobile enough. And you might be able to get them to into a good, somewhat Dix Hall Pike position, even while they're just seated and leaning back off of a chair.
All right. So that's helpful. So we get orthostatic vitals, which we've discussed in the past. They are stone cold normal. We now expertly perform a Dix Hall Pike maneuver. Let's say we did it on the exam table and managed to not brain the patient against the wall. Turn the head to the right, noticed upbeat torsional nystagmus, felt great about that with associated vertigo from the patient. We feel fairly confident now at this point, just based on everything you told us that we're dealing with BPPV. So when you're explaining this to the patient, like, I feel like I always get tripped up. I'm like, there's crystals and canals and stones and things like, and the patients sort of nod politely because they're usually very nice. But I guess, what's that? How do you explain it to patients in a way that is comprehensible? Because even I have a hard time understanding it.
Yeah, I think it's really important to have like a picture of the inner ear or a 3D model, which is what I have in clinic. I know not everybody's going to invest into one of those, but pulling up a picture from Google and showing them on your phone, this is what the inner ear looks like, pointing to the part where the crystals live, which is your otolith organs, the utricle or saccule, and saying, and this is the part where it gets stuck. I think what I'm trying to do in my clinic, even before this, is before I start my exam, I explain what the vestibular system is so that they know what I'm testing. And I am trying to say, like, hey, this is the basic thing that we're doing. Remember where I said that this is the part that senses motion of your head? Well, now there's a crystal stuck in there and it's in a thick fluid. And I describe the crystal as like snow in a snow globe getting shaken up and then settling down. So when that crystal is floating in that fluid, just like the snow in a snow globe, it's going to be hitting all your motion sensors and causing dizziness. But once it settles down at the bottom of that canal, or once it stops moving around, that's the point where your symptoms will go away, which is why you have that brief episodic dizziness that's only 30 seconds long. But having the visual, I think, is probably the most important part, and just pointing to where these things are so they can get an understanding.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's really scary for people. And also just, it seems, I hope I never have it, but it seems like they feel just terrible. So they just want to get relief. They want you to tell them that they're not having a stroke, and then they also want you to make them feel better. So let's talk about the EPLI maneuver. And then, is there anything else we can do non-pharmacologically or pharmacologically for patients with BPPV?
Yeah. So, you know, once I see BPPV in clinic, I go straight into the EPLI maneuver. So if I tested the right side and the right Dix Hall Pike and I see the characteristic nystagmus, I'm not going to sit the patient back up. I'm just going to go straight from that maneuver into the EPLI, because the first stage of the EPLI maneuver is the same as your Dix Hall Pike. Mm-hmm. So I just complete the treatment maneuver. In clinic, we don't have a ton of time. So I was trained to do one, quote, really good EPLI, where you hold the patient's head in that in each position for a minute. And just really keep them there and move them through the maneuver very slowly. After that, I often give them a referral to vestibular physical therapy if there's someone who can make it to another appointment, or if I think they're capable at home, I give them instructions on how to do an EPLI maneuver at home for that specific canal. In terms of prescriptions, some patients feel very poorly with the vertigo, and it does not feel great, you're right. So a very, very small prescription of meclizine, just a couple of days worth to use only if extremely severe, But more importantly, I say try and avoid the meclizine if you can, and I give them an anti-nausea medicine. So whatever anti-nausea medicine that you like to use is something I like to have on hand for the patient so that they can at least tolerate going through the maneuver and nausea doesn't impede them. The only other thing that I do really from a therapeutic standpoint or diagnostic standpoint in some of these patients is if they've had repetitive episodes of BPPV, I do check a vitamin D level. That has been the one thing, if you have low vitamin D, that has been associated, not exactly a cause, with repetitive BPPV.
Weird. Nothing else to say. Yeah, I suppose it's like it being an association, not a cause, makes sense, because the type of people who are prone to low vitamin D levels are probably also prone to BPPV, but it's still interesting nevertheless.
There's vitamin D receptors everywhere, I guess. That's news to me too. Okay. So let's say we confidently perform an EPLI maneuver in the clinic and also link Kathy to a video online for the modified EPLI maneuver so she can potentially self-treat in the future, and we send for the vitamin D testing. Is there subjective BPPV? You know, like if someone comes in, I do think sometimes you get the person that has dizziness and it sounds from the history like BPPV. You talked a little bit about having those glasses, so maybe we're missing it because of that. But even with the glasses, do you ever find the person that you would swear is BPPV, but the testing is negative?
Yeah, it definitely happens. You're most likely to catch BPPV early in the morning when the patient, you know, has been laying down all night, letting the crystals collect, and then they themselves get up and roll over in bed, and that's when they have their symptoms. And by the time they make it to you later that day for the acute appointment or weeks later, it's gone, but it sounded like BPPV. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But in those scenarios, if I don't see anything at all in clinic and it doesn't even reproduce their symptoms, that's when I say, you know, make an appointment with PT. And if your symptoms come back, keep your appointment. If they don't, just cancel it and keep me updated. There is, I don't want to say like controversy, but it's debated in the vestibular world of this type 2 BPPV, which is people who have symptoms and no nystagmus. And you're debated if that is true and can happen where you don't observe the nystagmus and people have the symptoms. And it doesn't really hurt, to be honest, to do an EPLI maneuver. So if you're suspicious, you can have the patient do an EPLI maneuver on the right and an EPLI maneuver on the left just to be extra sure that you treated both sides, even if you don't see anything in clinic. It's not something I typically do, but just as a practical point, like in a primary care office, I don't think it would be harmful for your patients. We don't usually have people do things like the maneuvers for the horizontal canal because that's gets really confusing and things can get all mixed up. But, you know, doing an EPLI maneuver is usually pretty safe.
Okay.
I can't remember if I ever shared on the show or not, Matt, but I had BPPV in my fourth year of medical school. It was exactly as you described, David, where I woke up one morning, turned over, the room started spinning around, I barfed into a trash can by the side of my bed, and it was very self-limited. Like, I self-EPLI'd, it got better pretty quickly, but I can confirm, feels bad. Like, it was not... It was a real bad experience, so do not recommend if you can avoid it.
Of course, you had the presence of mind, Paul, to just be like, oh, this is probably BPPV. I'm just going to do the EPLI maneuver on myself. Most fourth-year medical students would have been, you know, freaked out and, you know, gone to student health or something.
I was both freaked out as well, but yeah, maybe having done my family medicine rotation or being in the middle of it was also probably helpful at that point.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Let's move on to the next case. Eddie, would you do the honors reading the next case?
So Joe is a 50-year-old male with hypertension, type 2 diabetes, who's seeing you in the clinic for an acute visit for a one-day history of vertigo, nausea, vomiting, and some gait instability. The vertigo is sudden onset and has persisted. What are your initial concerns and differential, and kind of how are you going to tailor your history taking?
Yeah, so now we're in the realm of what we call the acute vestibular syndrome, which is what you alluded to earlier. And the acute vestibular syndrome is acute onset, sudden, continuous symptoms of dizziness, vertigo, or imbalance. often with nausea and vomiting that started abruptly and is still happening in front of you. So this person is right in front of you, symptoms are still there, and the two things that you want to think about when you see this patient is, are we in the realm of a peripheral problem, meaning vestibular neuritis, or is this a central localizing problem, something like an ischemic stroke or hemorrhagic stroke, which is the scary, don't want to miss diagnosis.
Yeah. And David, I asked you before we started recording about phone triage. I know there were some papers during the pandemic, just talking about phone triage for patients with dizziness. And this would be one where if this call came into my office, 50-year-old with high blood pressure, diabetes, and is having like a day of vertigo, nausea, vomiting, gait instability, I'd be worried for stroke. And this might be someone I send to the ER, but can you talk about how you might triage it and then just the general triage that your clinic has for this sort of thing?
Yeah. So for this patient, I completely agree. A person who has vascular risk factors, who has sudden onset dizziness that's continuous, and they've never had these symptoms before, that's concerning to me nonetheless. And I would send that person to the emergency department too for an acute evaluation if I couldn't see them myself, very easily, and then triage them to the ED myself. But otherwise, I think if you hear the story that is very suspicious for BPPV in your patient, like we heard earlier, like, do you have symptoms that are episodic? Is your dizziness provoked by laying down in bed or rolling over in bed? Those are questions that we use in our clinic to triage our patients to see a vestibular physical therapist prior to scheduling an appointment with neurology, for example. Or they use questions of, do you have changes with hearing associated with your dizziness, to triage them to see an ear, nose, and throat physician prior to coming to the neurologist. The question of headache and dizziness often gets triaged to our clinic first. Of course, we all see a mix of all of those patients, and that's completely okay. And we share a lot of patients between those specialties, but those are the general big buckets we might use to categorize someone.
I think that's helpful to us in primary care, thinking about where we might like triage or where we might refer to based on the type of dizziness we're seeing. So, okay, so we have this case here, and they're in the office, and You told us about the differential diagnosis. So vestibular neuritis, and I always have to look this up. So labyrinthitis means like everything's involved. So there's hearing loss potentially, as well as the dizziness, and vestibular neuritis is if it just is like sort of the dizziness vertigo happening. Is there any other differentiation between those two?
Yeah, no, that's correct. Labyrinthitis includes acute onset hearing loss. And, we can talk about later in our review of systems, or what we're thinking about is we do view hearing loss now as a new like kind of red flag symptom with the acute vestibular syndrome, rather than just lumping it together and assuming it's labyrinthitis. And it led us to an expanded version of the HINTS exam called the HINTS Plus, where the plus is thinking about hearing.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's another new one. Okay. Well, let's do the next part of the case then, Paul, and we'll keep going. This episode is brought to you by Quince. Listen, in the Watto household, Quince is a big deal. My wife loves Quince. I love Quince. I've pretty much converted all my wardrobe that actually looks nice over to Quince. I like their polos. I like their cashmere sweaters, the Mongolian cashmere sweater, which I have. My wife loves Quince. I think she has some pajamas, some sweats, some sweatshirts, some sweaters. And not only that, when she buys gifts for people, she's a lot of time buying them gifts from Quince because it's high quality, it's affordable, it's well made. You're gonna love it. This season's lineup is simple but smart and easy with Quince. They have $50 Mongolian cashmere sweaters that feel like an everyday luxury. They have wool coats that are equal parts stylish and durable. Their denim nails the fit and everyday comfort, all at a fraction of what you'd expect to pay. That's because by partnering directly with ethical factories and top artisans, Quince cuts out the middlemen to deliver premium quality at half the cost of other high-end brands. So, give and get timeless holiday staples that last this season with Quince. Go to quince.com/curb for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/curb. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/curb. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Most holiday gifts end up in a drawer or the back of your closet or accidentally left at your cousin's house, but not this one. Mint Mobile is offering unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month, and that's their best deal of the year, aka the only holiday gift you're actually going to use every single day. Like I said, this is the best deal of the year, and it's happening right now. Get a 3, 6, or 12-month unlimited plan for $15 per month. All Mint plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 5G network. You can bring your current phone and phone number over to Mint. No contracts and no nonsense. If you're in the market for a new wireless carrier right now, then Mint Mobile has to be your top choice because they have a great 5G network and the most affordable prices. So this holiday season, don't get them socks, get them premium wireless for $15 per month. Shop Mint Mobile plans at mintmobile.com/curb. That's mintmobile.com/curb. Limited time offer, upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra, initial plan term only. Over 35 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com.
Sure. So our patient Joe, a reminder, 50-year-old gentleman with high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, tells us he does not have a headache. He does not have neck pain. There have been no hearing changes specifically, but also no vision changes. He does not have difficulty speaking. He denies dysphagia. There have been no sensory changes or dysesthesias. There's no weakness. And even though he feels dizzy, he has not fallen. He also notes that he did have a recent cold. So I think we're trying to tee something up to be sort of reassuring. But I guess, nevertheless, with the risk factors that he has, I would still be extraordinarily nervous just as a nervous person at baseline. So what might you do on examination to kind of help tease things out and see how alarmed we should be or should not be?
Yeah, exactly. So as I just alluded to, we would utilize our HINTS exam, and HINTS is just an acronym for the tests or the things that I would do on my exam to try and differentiate between that central localizing stroke or that peripheral localizing vestibular neuritis. The reason that you should be scared or nervous is that stroke and vestibular neuritis on paper or by description can sound exactly the same, and we have to use our exam to differentiate between the two. So HINTS just stands for head impulse test, nystagmus, or looking at the patient's eyes for abnormal eye movements, and the TS is test of skew, looking for what's called a skew deviation or a vertical misalignment of the eyes. It just mentioned that now we think of it as HINTS plus, and the plus is trying to understand, does the patient have sudden onset hearing loss at the time of their sudden onset dizziness? Now, if it's the first time for that and it's the acute vestibular syndrome and the patient has hearing loss, we view hearing loss as a red flag because the labyrinth is supplied by the anterior inferior cerebellar artery, or ICA. So an ICA stroke can cause, what appears to be on your exam, like a looks peripheral, but it's actually a stroke because it's causing that hearing loss too. That's, of course, in the absence of any like obvious cause for that hearing loss. So if the person has, a purulent discharge from their ear or vesicles to suggest Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, you have a clear explanation of why they have hearing loss. But if not, we start to view that as a, okay, could this be central localizing until proven otherwise?
Wow. Something else to be scared about, Paul.
Yeah, perfect. I've been sleeping so well lately. Can I have you talk us through at least, I would like to revisit the HINTS exam briefly, Matt. I hope that's okay. But the head impulse test, I think, is one that people are especially confounded by in terms of, even reporting it and what the significance of whether someone's sort of able to fix it or not. So if you could sort of at least sort of talk us through that one, and we can certainly touch on the other ones if you think it's worth taking the time to do so.
Yeah. So what I'd say is that the head impulse test is something that's really tricky. I spent a whole year in a fellowship all about dizziness, and I had to practice a head impulse test on every patient I saw. And that only after that point did I feel comfortable with it. So it's really important to just practice so that you become comfortable with this maneuver. But it's a test of the eighth cranial nerve, and it's testing the patient's vestibulo-ocular reflex. You perform it by just having the patient sit upright. You have the patient look at your nose as a target, and then you quickly move their head only 10 to 15 degrees while they're asked to look at your nose. And normal response of the test is when there is no catch-up saccade, meaning that the patient's eyes stay looking at your nose the entire time as you're quickly moving their head. A head impulse test is abnormal when there is a catch-up saccade, and that means when you turn the patient's head quickly, their eyes fall off of your nose, they look away, and then they correct back and look back to your nose, which is termed that catch-up saccade. When you see a catch-up saccade, that is a peripheral localizing finding on your HINTS exam. And it is something that you really have to practice or watch a video of online to become comfortable seeing, because I think it can be a little bit tricky to interpret. So it's okay to, if it's not something that comes natural. It's just something we have to practice. Just in terms of terminology for your head impulse test, it's important to remember that we try not to say a positive head impulse test or a negative head impulse test, just because nobody really knows what positive or negative is. So I think it's best to just say there was a catch-up saccade present with head impulse test, which implies that peripheral localization, or there was no catch-up saccade with head impulse test, which would, of course, make you suspicious for a central localizing problem in the patient with acute vestibular syndrome. That way, it's just documented clearly, and everybody will know what you're talking about.
That is a good alt. I like it because the positive-negative thing is like, yeah, it is, it's confusing.
Right. I think you forget to know which to be reassured by when you frame it that way. So I think that's, yeah you're being specific about self-help. And so just to, again, recap and compare and contrast. So Dix Hall Pike, not to be done during an acute attack, whereas the HINTS exam, the utility is when actually someone is in the midst of an acute attack. Is that correct or fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So you only want to apply your HINTS exam in the patient with acute onset continuous dizziness, and that's the only time to use it. Otherwise, it won't make sense when you try to interpret the results.
So the patient that has hours or a day or more of just continuous dizziness, and that's another thing I find hard. Sometimes I really have to say, wait. So they say I've been dizzy for the past 2 days, and I say, well, you've been dizzy the entire time, or you're dizzy, and then it goes away, and then you're dizzy again, and you know sometimes people say, well, it kind of peaks, and then I don't feel well, but then it'll come back when I do certain things. So it can be kind of tricky. But when I've seen these cases of acute vestibular syndrome, like I'm able to kind of from the history get them to say, yeah, like it's not going away no matter what I do. I'm just dizzy. If I move, it's worse.
Yeah, a way that I like to ask the patient to try and get out that nuance is, when you're sitting completely still and not moving, are you still dizzy? And then a lot of times patients will be like, oh, you know, actually, like it does go away if I settle down and don't move. But that patient with the acute vestibular syndrome will be like, oh, absolutely not. No, like I still feel that sensation of motion.
Okay. So we've talked about the head impulse test. When you're looking at nystagmus, can you just remind us what are you doing there? Are you having them do the normal follow my finger stuff and observing their eyes? Just talk us through that, and we can then talk about the test of skew as well.
Yeah. So when I'm looking for nystagmus in a patient, I'm giving them a small target. So I have them look at the end of my reflex hammer and I just hold them in each of the kind of like cardinal directions for at least 10, 15 seconds. So I have them stare straight ahead and look forward. And I observe if there's any spontaneous nystagmus. And then I have them look all the way to the left. And I have them look all the way to the right, all the way up, and all the way down. And what I'm looking for is if there is any nystagmus at all. And if there is nystagmus, which direction is the fast phase, or which direction is it quickly moving in? When someone has a peripheral localizing problem, like a vestibular neuritis, the pattern of nystagmus that you're going to see is horizontal, meaning that the fast movement is moving horizontally, and it's going to be unidirectional or always beating in the same direction. So if that patient is looking forward and they have spontaneous left beating nystagmus, when they look to the left, it's still going to be left beating. When they look to the right, it's still going to be left beating. And when they look up and down, it's still going to be left beating. So a horizontal unidirectional pattern of nystagmus is the nystagmus pattern that would fit with a peripheral pattern. Mm-hmm. I think it's then easy to remember, well, that's peripheral. So anything other than that pattern is concerning for central localizing process. So that would be just specifically the most common would be something like direction changing nystagmus. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was a resident, I was like, what does that mean? It just means when you look to the left, the nystagmus is beating to the left. And when you have the patient look to their right, the nystagmus would be beating to the right. Or when they look up, it's beating to the, toward the ceiling, for example. But the other things that could be central would be a pure vertical nystagmus, a pure torsional nystagmus. Those would also be concerning central localizing patterns of nystagmus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And I have been able to remember even it's years since I've like reviewed this, but it like has stuck with me. The horizontal unidirectional is more peripheral and anything else is concerning for a central process. So that's a good way to remember it. And the last part of this is the test of skew. So how are you doing that one?
Yeah, so test of skew is your chance to look for a vertical eye misalignment. And the way that you perform the test of skew test is you have the patient sit upright, look at a distant target. So in our exam rooms, I have them look at the P in Purell on the... in the emergency department. So they have something to look at across the room. And then while they're looking, you're just going to cover one eye with your hand and then move your hand to the other eye, hold each eye covered for about 2 to 3 seconds, and then switch to the opposite and move back and forth. And you're going to look at the eye that you just uncovered to see if there's a vertical movement of that eye. So does the eye vertically move to find that target that you told them to look at? And that vertical eye misalignment is called a skew deviation in the setting of that acute vestibular syndrome. Now, a lot of people have horizontal eye misalignments, and that can certainly be normal. Skew deviations are usually pretty obvious, and the patient symptomatically would have vertical double vision or vertical diplopia. So you don't need to like squint and look and see like, oh, do I think there's like a tiny little vertical movement of the eyes? It's usually a larger or more obvious vertical movement of the eyes that you're going to be looking for. And when okay. you see that, you should be concerned that this is central localizing.
And then I call you because I'm not, I don't take care of strokes.
Just one last thing that I want to say, like about the HINTS exam, is that same thing with naming. We call something either a peripheral localizing HINTS exam or a central localizing HINTS exam. We try again to avoid positive HINTS or negative HINTS because, you know, we don't know what positive or negative means. And the important part is for something to be peripheral localizing, each part of the HINTS exam needs to be satisfy the peripheral localizing criteria. So there's like an and. So to briefly say that, that's a catch-up saccade present, and there's horizontal unidirectional nystagmus, and there's no vertical eye misalignment, and the patient has normal hearing. And if you can say all of that, then you're like, I'm confident that this is peripheral localizing. But if only one thing is true in the central column, then you should be concerned for something that's central localizing until proven otherwise.
And we talked about how MRI in the first, 72 hours is not 100% sensitive. What's the latest with that? And how do you recommend we handle that? If we have a positive HINTS, or if we have a centrally localizing HINTS exam, I did that on purpose so I could correct myself. If we have a centrally localizing exam, is an MRI the next step, or should we wait a day or two before we get it?
Yeah, so if you have a central localizing HINTS exam, you should treat it as if the patient has a stroke until proven otherwise. So depending on like the setting that you're working in, if that patient's in the emergency department in front of you and you're within a thrombolytic window, you should be talking with your stroke team about that. But if they're outside of that window, you know, you should go down whatever normal stroke pathway you would go down. Of course, many emergency departments, but not all, have access to MRIs quickly. So it's not something that needs to happen that same day. But if something is central localizing and you get an MRI within the first 24 hours, you technically might wonder, like, well, if I repeated the MRI in 72 hours, would something show up or change? But that's then going to have to be kind of like a more nuanced risk-benefit discussion, yeah, often with neurology involved.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone that has a stroke, I'm getting you involved. I'm not comfortable with strokes, Paul. I don't know about you.
No, it's appropriately. Yeah. I think as soon as I see like a centrally localizing test of skew, shall we say, that is someone who is going to be heading to the ER, do not pass go, and talking to my neuro colleagues.
Yeah. So, but let's say fortunately for our patient, there's no focal neurologic deficit. We perform a HINTS plus exam. There is a catch-up saccade with the head impulse test, and he meets all the other criteria for a peripheral localizing exam. So we feel confident it's vestibular neuritis. There's no hearing loss because we did the HINTS plus exam. We don't send him to the hospital. How would you talk to Joe about vestibular neuritis, then the expected prognosis, and if there's anything to be done?
Yeah, so I just explained that vestibular neuritis is a one-time episode because I think patients often ask, like, is this going to be something that could happen again? And that the episode is likely due to some sort of inflammation of the nerve that connects the brain to the ear that has led to low vestibular function and an imbalance between the left and the right side of the vestibular system. And that they can expect to have some degree of dizziness or imbalance for the coming weeks and sometimes months. But that the goal is going to be working with a vestibular physical therapist to basically strengthen the other side, which in the end will pick up the slack for the side with the low vestibular function after vestibular neuritis. It's okay to use a vestibular suppressant like meclizine for a very short course. And by that, I mean like 2 or 3 days of meclizine. And maybe having some on hand if the patient has a very, you know, particularly bad day. But we don't want the patient to develop chronic vestibular suppressant use, which can lead to other forms of chronic dizziness and might hinder their recovery back to normal.
For the rehab and physical therapy, do you wait until they start to turn the corner from this? Like you wouldn't, like day two of symptoms, you're not going to throw them right into this. You wait until the dizziness has kind of gotten better.
So I send them to vestibular physical therapy as soon as they're able to get an appointment. Vestibular physical therapists are extremely knowledgeable. So they'll know like how hard or easy to go on a patient based on where they are in their symptoms. It may be as simple as the vestibular neuritis is meeting, or the vestibular physical therapist is meeting their patient and doing their initial assessment and just giving the patient a few easy exercises to do at home, because the sooner they can start their recovery, the better.
Paul, have you met the patient that's on meclizine for like 20 years?
Yeah, I was thinking about that each time you said a short course, or maybe sometimes you have to, every so often you will inherit the patient or see someone who's just on meclizine in perpetuity for reasons that are completely mysterious. And it feels bad. So it's nice to hear from an expert that, yes, that is indeed bad. So thank you.
Yeah, it's like somebody gets a PPI and then they're just on it for the rest of their life. It seems like it's not quite as bad as that, but I do have a lot of patients that will just like, they always want to have that prescription for the meclizine around, and some of them are taking it more often than I'm comfortable with. Okay, well, we have one more case to get to, and I definitely want to make a few minutes for this one, because this is a newer diagnosis, at least to me. So Eddie, would you do the honors?
Joan is a 30-year-old female with a past male history of depression, anxiety with panic disorder, who's coming to her clinic to talk about dizziness. This seemed to start 3 months ago after she had a panic attack on a crowded bus. Since then, she's had daily symptoms of dizziness described as swaying on a boat without any spinning sensations that last a majority of the day. Symptoms are worsened when she's walking through busy traffic or grocery stores, or if she's feeling more anxious. The physical exam, including orthostatic vitals, Dick's Hallpike, and a Hintz Plus exam, is normal. What is your approach for a patient like this with an unremarkable exam and this chronic non-spinning vertigo or dizziness?
Yeah, so chronic dizziness is something that makes up a lot of the patients I see in my outpatient clinic, because the acute and episodic patients often are, you know, meeting their primary doctor first. So the patient with chronic dizziness is trying to go through, a series of exam and diagnostic steps to make sure that I'm not missing anything that could be causing their symptoms. And my broad overview of how I approach this is, I think of the three systems that are important for balance: our vision, our proprioception or sensation, and our vestibular system. So my exam is focused on making sure all of those systems are normal or working as they should. Persistent postural perceptual dizziness, where we abbreviate it and call it triple PD, is classified as a functional neurologic disorder, and it makes up about 20% of the patients that subspecialty vestibular neurology clinics see. So you're trying to understand, you know, is there anything that could be mimicking or causing this, like bilateral vestibular loss or a bilateral vestibulopathy or a cerebellar ataxia, or the things that I'd be looking for as a neurologist. And in the absence of those things, I can, you know, help make a diagnosis of this triple PD. Triple PD, though, has specific diagnostic criteria that patients have to meet. So it's all in the name, persistent, which is more there more days than not for 3 months. Postural, patients feel worse when they're upright and moving. Perceptual, some sort of visual perceptual stimuli, like a busy or crowded place, a phone screen that's scrolling, certain patterns cause dizziness. And it's often a non-spinning type of movement, like rocking, bobbing, or swaying. It's important to note that triple PD happens after like some sort of trigger. So the patient had vestibular neuritis and they got put on chronic meclizine and never was referred to vestibular PT. And what we think might happen is that there could be some essentially brain miswiring, which leads them to become more visually dependent rather than vestibular dependent. And it can lead to this type of perceptual dizziness, which is the umbrella category that we put it under. So I know that was a lot of different things of like my approach and how I get to this chronic dizziness diagnosis, but it's certainly something that is challenging for many of our patients.
Yeah. I know in Philadelphia, there's a bunch of places have just centers for dizziness because and there, and like you said, there's ENT, there's neurology, there's vestibular physical therapists in those places just trying to sort this out, because it can get really tricky and really murky when it's been around for a long time and the history kind of piles up. So there was the one fun, not fun necessarily, but the Mal de debarkment, the syndrome of disembarkation or sickness of disembarkation. I mean, that doesn't seem like that could be mistaken for this, but is that's out there as well. That seems like more of a benign thing. This PPDD seems, you said it's a functional disorder and it's just more chronic.
And yeah, you know, triple PD and mal de debarkment, or we say MDDS, can really actually present very similarly, where people have chronic non-spinning sensations of movement. The key for mal de debarkment syndrome is that it happens within a couple of days of being exposed to passive motion. So you may have heard of, like, you've been on a boat for a while and you have to, quote, get your land legs back, or that feeling you have when you've gotten off of a boat. Well, for people who have MDDS, you know, unfortunately, the symptom is persistent and it does not go away. And they have that chronic rocking, bobbing, swaying feeling that's there all day and every day. And it can be very troubling for patients, unfortunately.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding. To meet diagnostic criteria for MDDS, you actually have to have that exposure to the sort of swaying movement first, and then it persists?
Yeah. Specifically, they say, like, in the diagnostic criteria, that you've been exposed to some sort of passive motion. So, like, a train ride, a boat ride, or even, like, a long car ride.
Well, my kids were on the treadmill the other day, and they were just, like, they were like racing each other, and they got off and they're like, I feel like I'm still moving. Why do I feel like I'm still moving? And then, like, a day later I read this and I'm like, oh, they had mal de, well, not, you know, I guess it wasn't like syndromic, cause it goes away after like 10 seconds, but it's kind of cool.
I don't think I realized it truly debarkment had to be part of the criteria. Like, I knew that the sensation of it, of the sort of being kind of on a ship, like, at that part, I knew, with the fact that you actually had to have that passive exposure to movement is incredible stuff.
And if we have any listeners who know how to pronounce this in a fancy way, please send us a voicemail. I would love to hear.
I'm pretty sure the way you did it was right, Matt. I think you nailed it.
Okay, so treatment for this kind of thing. What does that look like? If someone has triple PD, what are you doing to treat that?
Yeah, for patients who have triple PD, the diagnostic, you know, approach, or that, I think the most important thing in terms of your treatment is first, like, giving your patient a diagnosis. Just like you said, these patients often have seen numerous physicians and they've bounced around from clinic to clinic and seen ENTs and audiologists and PT. So I think just giving their symptoms a name and explaining, like, what they have and what's going on can be therapeutic by itself. Mm-hmm. But after that portion of it, of delivering the diagnosis and going through the diagnostic criteria so they understand what's going on, is three things mainly. One, vestibular physical therapy, or any type of, like, healthy, engaging movement, because lack of movement really reinforces this problem. Two, we do use SSRIs or SNRI medications to treat the chronic dizziness, often in quite low doses, like starting at half of the lowest dose sometimes, because these patients often have medication sensitivity. So you're really giving them a chance to become comfortable with the medicine as you increase it. And the last part, if necessary, is, you know, the way I describe it to my patients is addressing the impact that it's had, because they've often, you know, stopped doing things they love. And it's can lead to the development of comorbid anxiety and depression, unfortunately, or worsen pre-existing mood disorders. So they may need to work with a cognitive behavioral therapist or a health psychologist to really get over some of the symptoms that they've been experiencing. And all three of those treatment aspects can be important for the patient. And I found that not just one in isolation is often helpful.
So you're sort of empathizing, addressing how this has impacted their life, vestibular rehab, SSRI or SNRI, and the lowest dose is like half the tablet of the smallest size pill, and then CBT to cognitive behavioral therapy or some sort of behavioral support for this as well. That all makes sense. I imagine these patients probably come to you, they've already had MRIs and they've had other types of tests. Is there anything you recommend we send before we refer these patients to you? Is like head imaging pretty standard for before you're comfortable that it's triple PD?
Yeah, but you know, part of us making the diagnosis is making sure there's nothing else going on. So along with the exam that we do, seeing an MRI is always helpful just to make sure that we're not overlooking anything.
Yeah. Paul, I think we've been efficient tonight for us. I think we're at the end of the questions that I have. Do you have additional questions, or are you ready to go to take-home points?
I think I'm ready for take-home points. Yeah, I think it helps to have a guest who's extraordinarily organized in terms of their teaching. So great job, David. But is there anything in particular you would like our listeners to really take away from this episode? If there's, what are the must-have take-home points for the folks who listen today?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is just remembering how we approach the patient in the very first place. So don't overemphasize the description of their symptoms, but instead try and categorize them as acute, episodic, or chronic. And if episodic, was it spontaneous or was it triggered by something? And if you can put somebody in that category, you're not only building your differential diagnosis, but you know which exam to choose. So for that acute vestibular syndrome patient, you know you're going to use your HINTS exam to differentiate between central and peripheral problems. And for the patients with episodic dizziness, you're going to do things like make sure they don't have BPPV, check your orthostatic vital signs, and then really use the associated symptoms to understand if there's other problems like vestibular migraine or meniere's, for example.
Last question, anything you'd like to plug or websites, papers you published, band you like? I don't know.
I think if I had to plug anything or any resource, it's your local vestibular physical therapist. They know most of the things that I was talking about today, and they're experts in it as well. And I think they're often an underutilized resource. So, you know, working with and knowing who your local vestibular PT is can be very helpful. And, you know, the Vestibular Disorders Association website, vestibular.org, has a directory of vestibular physical therapists to make it easy to find someone to help your patient.
All right. Thank you. And we'll take this into the outro.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Oh, nicely done, Eddie. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes, Matt, our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
Paul, I thought we were changing it to brain holes after episode 500.
I mean, but you change it in the script and I will change it. We've gone over this. I'm the Ron Burgundy of medical podcasting.
We're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for all health professionals for CME credit through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Eddie Jang, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Waddle runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Waddle.
I've been Edison Eddie Jang.
Strong. And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.